I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD from Slate, in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. We start this week with the latest from the CDC.
Today is another day we can take a step back to the normalcy of before. Over the past year, we have spent a lot of time telling Americans what they cannot do, what they should not do. Today, I'm going to tell you some of the things you can do if you are fully vaccinated.
Last week, the CDC released new COVID-19 guidelines relaxing the wearing of masks outdoors as the vaccine rollout continues and cases decline across the U.S. While it's still recommended that people wear masks in crowded areas like at concerts and sporting events, the CDC says those who are fully vaccinated no longer need to wear masks in small gatherings or while walking, running, and dining outdoors.
The science shows if you are vaccinated, you can do so safely unmasked.
The CDC also says that unvaccinated people can forego masks in outdoor settings. For some people, the new guidance comes as a relief, a glimpse into our slow return to some sense of normalcy. But for others, the new rules are causing even more confusion. And you told us about it.
So pretty soon I'll be considered fully vaccinated. But what if I'm in an elevator with someone who has COVID and they're coughing? I'm going to continue double masking and keeping distance from strangers. I'm going to look at those things as wearing my big boy pants.
This is Doris from Greenville, South Carolina. All the adults in my family group are fully vaccinated. We all are still masking, avoiding crowds, not eating indoors at restaurants, not eating out really at all. I consider the risk to my grandchildren, all children, to still be too high to go back to pre-pandemic normal. We don't really know yet what all the long-term and potentially permanent side effects might be.
Hi, this is Mary from Fremont. I thought, yay, and went for a walk without my mask. But passing by others who would not know whether or not I had been fully vaccinated felt uncomfortable. So I decided to continue to mask up. It feels more supportive to the community to do so.
For more on this, we're joined by Dr. Megan Ranney, emergency physician and associate dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. Dr. Ranney, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Lizzie. It's a joy to be here with you.
So what exactly do the new guidelines say for vaccinated people and unvaccinated people? Let's lay them out first.
Absolutely. So really the big place that there are changes here are for vaccinated people. And the new guidelines basically say if you're vaccinated, you can go without a mask in most outdoor activities, particularly if you're with mostly other vaccinated people. So this is more of the same from the CDC, saying that if you're around only vaccinated people, you can be unmasked either outdoors or indoors. The big change for unvaccinated people is just saying for the first time, listen, you can go for walks and runs or bike rides outside without a mask, as long as you're just with your family group. And then reinforcing, if you're unvaccinated and only around other vaccinated people, you could be without a mask in that small group. Nothing else has changed. None of the recommendations for indoor masking have changed, and none of the recommendations, particularly for unvaccinated people in big groups, have changed.
There's been some criticism, notably in The Atlantic, a couple other places, saying this is really complicated. There's like this color-coded flowchart. Do you think the guidance might confuse people?
I think it may confuse people, and there are two really important things that I tell folks, and I will say, my phone blew up with text messages and emails and phone calls last Tuesday after the recommendations came out with this confusion. So what I tell people is two things. The first is, if you are vaccinated, this is more proof that vaccines are our ticket back to normality. So if you are vaccinated and you are around, if you are around vaccinated people, you can go unmasked. The second big thing is that you still have a choice. You know, those listener quotes that you played at the beginning, the folks that still want to wear masks because it feels supportive of their community or because they don't feel comfortable being unmasked, that is okay. You absolutely can still mask. This is just telling you that the science supports that outdoors, it's all right to take the masks off.
You know, I think back to something that a scientist told me at the beginning of the pandemic, which is that we are often used to, as a public, consuming science at the end point. But with COVID-19, it's a novel virus. This is a process. And I think about how the CDC has rolled out this guidance. It feels like they say, you must do this one thing. No, you must do this other thing. I wonder what would have happened or what might happen if they say, hey, it's a process, we're learning.
I love that. I think that we have been hamstrung in a bunch of ways across this pandemic. The first, of course, is that last spring, the CDC was not allowed to put out true science-based recommendations. They were under tremendous political pressure from the executive branch that lost the trust of the public. And
well, we also had people say, you know, Tony Fauci included, hey, you don't need a mask unless you're a healthcare worker.
True. And you know what? At that point in the pandemic, I'll say as an ER doc, we were short on masks and every mask that was out there needed to be saved for us in healthcare. B, we didn't know it was aerosolized, right? We did not know that this virus spread through the air back when Dr. Fauci said that. But you're right. Absolutely, we should have nuance. And I think when you look at this CDC chart, it has a little more nuance than we've seen in the past. I'm also telling folks to expect more changes to come. And as you said, this is not a black and white issue. The pandemic is unfortunately shades of gray, and science is progressing and recommendations will continue to progress. Vaccinations are progressing and recommendations will change as we get more vaccines out there.
As you heard in those listener clips, you know, obviously mask wearing has become political, but there's also this sort of community thing where maybe you're fully vaccinated, but there's no way to convey to someone you're passing, hey, my mask is down because I'm fully vaccinated. What would you say to people who are worried about being perceived as, you know, not taking this seriously? Because there is no way to convey that to people you're passing.
Totally. I mean, if you're out on a bike trail or hiking or going for a walk in your neighborhood, whether you are vaccinated or not, it is safe to be unmasked as long as you're not in a crowd. If you're getting together with people outdoors, I would ask folks before you agree to go to a dinner party or a barbecue or a pool party, I would ask if people are vaccinated. And I will say there are pins for sale saying I'm vaccinated. There's a local company here in Rhode Island called Pinning Me that makes these gorgeous little pins with state insignias. And, you know, so you can wear a pin to show that you're vaccinated. And again, wearing a mask isn't a bad thing. It's just to know that if you want to take it off in these very specific settings, it's okay.
How much do you think the average person listens to the CDC at this point?
You know, I'm hearing from people across the spectrum that they're feeling distrustful of the CDC's recommendations. And as a public health professional and an ER doctor, that makes me really sad because the CDC has been the shining light of public health for our world for well over 100 years. I think right now it's really on the media, on those of us in medicine and public health who do have a bit more of a platform to help share and interpret these guidelines until the CDC regains the trust of the American public.
Maybe I'm being a bit of a Pollyanna here, but I wonder if in some places where there has been resistance to masking, if these guidelines might come across as more reasonable or maybe just, you know, a little easier to take. No, you don't have to wear them when you're walking the dog, but yes, when you're going to the grocery store, you do. Or do you think it's become so divisive that sort of the ship has sailed in terms of being able to capture some people on the margins?
You know, there are so many states that have completely lifted mask mandates even before these CDC recommendations came out. I think there are some folks who are simply not going to wear masks indoors unless forced to, regardless of CDC recommendations. That said, I do think that these recommendations are important because they show that the CDC follows the science. And the science says that if you are vaccinated, you are much lower risk of catching COVID. And if you are outdoors because of the way the virus spreads through the air, you're much lower risk. And so I think it's important just from that perspective that it shows that the CDC is willing to change as the science evolves.
What does all of this mean for kids? I have a baby. A lot of people have kids who have been cooped up. And, you know, parents are struggling. Kids are struggling. How do we get this across to parents? But also, you know, kids can't be vaccinated yet. So what advice do you have for parents who are trying to help their kids not lose their minds and socialize a little bit right now.
I get it. I have an elementary school kid and a middle schooler, and so I feel that pain every single day. The most important thing for kids is to stay masked at school and to stay masked at those extracurricular or social activities, particularly if they're indoors. We are seeing rising rates of infection for kids across the country linked to social activities and extracurricular activities, not to being in school, because most schools across the country are requiring masks. So if you're doing an outdoor play date with one other family and your kids are going to be at a little bit of a distance, it's safe to take off those masks. But if they're close together, if they're in a big group, if they're playing soccer or kind of contact sports, those masks are really critical to keep on for right now. And then fingers crossed that we're going to have vaccines for age 12 and up, hopefully by the end of this week, if all goes well.
Given all of this, if you're making like an individual risk budget for your family, which is something I do every day, how do we think about risk, especially if, say, you've got, you know, parents who are vaccinated?
Absolutely. So the way that I think about it is a few things. The first is, what is the chance that the activity that you're doing puts you in contact with a person who has COVID? Obviously, if all the people there are vaccinated, that risk is really, really low. So it's safe to take off the mask. As the number of people goes up that you're around, the chance of one of them having COVID increases. And of course, if you're in a community with high rates of COVID, that chance of someone else at your get together having COVID increases again. So that's the first question. And then the second question is, how likely, if there is someone there with COVID, how likely are you to be exposed to it? Again, being outdoors is much lower risk than being indoors. Having a well-ventilated area is lower risk than a poorly ventilated area. And a crowd is higher risk than something where people are distanced. And I think about those in terms of those two things. And then how much am I willing to take on the chance of myself or my family getting sick? Listen, my husband is almost fully vaccinated. I've been fully vaccinated since January. Once my husband is fully vaccinated, I'm going to take on a little more risk because I'm no longer going to be worried that either of us are going to get super sick, hospitalized, or die. And I think that for each family across the U.S., we're going to continue to make those calculations as this pandemic, unfortunately, continues to progress and become something that just becomes part of the daily fabric of our life.
Dr. Megan Ranney is an ER physician and associate dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. In the aftermath of a natural disaster, a lot of people turn to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, for temporary housing and financial assistance to rebuild their homes and communities. But recent reporting from the Washington Post found that the agency has become more restrictive in approving applications for aid. Between 2017 and 2020, 6 million households applied for assistance and 4 million were rejected. As the climate crisis continues and some natural disasters intensify, FEMA could play a big role in helping people get back on their feet. But whether or not the agency is going to be able to respond in a meaningful way, that's yet to be determined. Joining me now to talk about FEMA's role in providing disaster assistance is Hannah Dreyer. She's a national reporter at The Washington Post. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Lizzie.
Let's do a quick refresher on what FEMA does after a disaster. There's emergency food and shelter, aid to cities and towns, and then there's this individual assistance program. What's it supposed to do?
So this is a huge part of FEMA's mission. This program is the program that is going to help people whose homes were destroyed, who are trying to put their lives together after a disaster. And for years and years, it used to be that after a hurricane or a flood, people would apply for this help, and most people would get it. They would get grants of up to about $70,000 to start putting their lives together. And then in the last 5 years or so, that's really changed, and FEMA has started rejecting almost everybody who applies for that kind of help.
Yeah, you found that FEMA used to approve about two-thirds of applicants, and they've become more restrictive when it comes to doling out this aid. What started that change?
You know, I was really surprised when we got these numbers from FEMA. I sort of figured that as natural disasters get worse and get more frequent, the agency would be more generous with this kind of aid and be doing more to get that aid out. But it seems like what happened is that after Hurricane Katrina, FEMA came under a lot of criticism for letting fraud slip through. And so is as a reaction to that, the agency has now gone the other way and really makes people jump through hoops to show that they are who they say they are, that they own their home, that they live where they say they do. And that kind of proof can be really hard to come by right after disaster. Like if your home's just been destroyed, how are you going to find the title to that home?
Right.
But FEMA is just really wants people to prove a lot of things that are hard to prove in the aftermath of a disaster.
You profiled this woman named Kim Schmadeke, and I was kind of floored by her story. Tell me about her and what happened to her.
So she lives in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Iowa was hit by a very strange sort of inland hurricane storm back in August. I spent a couple weeks with Kim. She is a taxi driver in Cedar Rapids, and she lives in a trailer. Her trailer was hit terribly by this storm. And now, almost 8 months later, her toilet is sinking through the floor. There are holes in the floor that she's marked with buckets so she doesn't step through them. Water is still pouring down the walls from places where the roof got torn away by this storm. And she is a very low-income person. She can't afford to make these repairs. It would cost about $20,000 to repair the home. And so she applied for FEMA help, and FEMA rejected her because she couldn't prove that she owned her home. And she did the very rare thing that only about 3% of people did, and she appealed that rejection. And so then FEMA realized, no, she does own her home, but they sent her $48, and she's looking at thousands of dollars of repairs. And so she's been fighting with FEMA, but her home is in much worse shape than it was, you know, a couple weeks after the disaster.
I mean, I think of someone like Kim, and often when we're talking about disasters, we're talking about low-income people who are hit the worst. If they try again and again, or as you're suggesting, most people just don't have either the emotional or financial wherewithal to do that. What's the toll on them when that happens?
I mean, for Kim, it's been incredibly lonely and anxiety-provoking. She still doesn't know if she's going to end up homeless, if she's going to maybe have to move into some sort of halfway house. She's 60, so she almost qualifies for some benefits for older people, but not quite. And she's a taxi driver, so I hung out with her just going around in her taxi. And the thing was, felt like almost everybody in this town had some version of this story. So she would pull up in front of a house where there's a tarp on the roof or the side of the wall gone or a tree still sort of laying on the porch, and she would ask, you know, how people were doing, and they would have their own stories of not being able to get help from FEMA and just feeling alone and feeling in a panic.
Isn't helping people like this FEMA's job? How do they justify these denials?
So FEMA says that it has to balance the mandate to help people and the importance of not letting abusers take advantage of the system and sort of steal taxpayer money by pretending to be a disaster victim. So the agency
is that a big problem?
Well, in Cedar Rapids, 22,000 people applied for help. 19,000 people were rejected. And the agency says maybe 2,000 people they think were trying to abuse the system, so weren't really disaster survivors. You know, it's I'll leave it to listeners to decide if that's a big enough percentage. But yeah, for the disaster survivors, what they told me is they don't want to have to jump through these extra hoops. They don't want the burden to be on them to prove that they really have this damage. They want FEMA to give them the benefit of the doubt in the aftermath of these terrible things.
How do lawmakers or the Biden administration sort of respond to this, what seems to be strong evidence from you, that households are not getting the assistance that they should be getting?
It seems like there actually might be some action around this issue in the coming year. This is something that it's been getting more difficult to get help through Republican and Democratic administrations. But this administration says it's really committed to equity issues and is already asking FEMA to start reviewing these issues. Also, in the aftermath of this story, some lawmakers have been sending letters to FEMA asking them to look into this. So I think there's more prospect for change than there has been in the past. And it's especially urgent because disasters are getting worse. You know, there was a record number of major hurricanes last year. There was double the amount of disaster damage last year as the year before. So this is an issue with sort of renewed urgency.
Hannah Dreyer is a national reporter at The Washington Post. Hannah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Last week, the Florida State Legislature passed a bill limiting access to drop boxes and raising requirements for voting by mail in the state. Florida Republicans, who drafted and passed the bill, say it's intended to secure future elections. But Democrat Craig Latimer, president of the Florida Supervisors of Elections, says that the bill was pushed through the state government following, quote, an unnecessary call for election reform. The bill now goes to Republican Governor Ron DeSantis' desk, where he's expected to sign it into law. The Sunshine State is part of a growing list of GOP-controlled states that are moving to pass voting restrictions in the wake of the 2020 election, during which President Trump, of course, falsely said there was widespread voter fraud. Joining us now to help us understand what this bill is set to do is Lawrence Maurer, a reporter with the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times. Lawrence, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So what limitations does this bill place on election drop boxes?
Well, it does it in a few ways. One of them is that it restricts them to use only during early voting hours, and it requires them to be manned at all times, which election supervisors have been concerned about because it adds a burden. I mean, it's a cost burden. You have to pay for people to man these things. And they wanted video surveillance as a low-cost method, but did not get that.
And then there are restrictions on voting by mail as well?
That's right. Yes, you now have to submit more information to request a vote by mail ballot. You have to give either the last four of a social security number or the number on your driver's license or your state-issued ID. In addition, Florida for the last few years has been allowing people to request ballots for the next two general elections. Wow. That's now scaled back to the next general election, basically every 2 years.
How does this law compare to the kind of restrictions we've seen passed in Georgia?
It's similar in some ways as far as the rhetoric. Florida's law also, Georgia got a lot of notoriety for trying to crack down on giving people things in line. Florida's law does mention that. It's not quite as cut and dry as a lot of critics think. It basically prohibits people from passing out any or soliciting voters while they're in line. You're allowed to go through and give someone something while they're in line, but you're not allowed to solicit them in Florida, which isn't a drastic change. It's something that we'll have to wait and see if this actually bears out to be something that would keep people from helping people who are in line.
One of the criticisms, of course, is that voters of color tend to be disproportionately impacted by legislation like this. Is that the case here in Florida?
Certainly, that was the criticism. And in Florida, certainly you have seen Republicans try to limit the types of voting popularly used by Black voters in particular. You know, Rick Scott years ago, of course, wanted to crack down on Sunday early voting, so-called so-called so's to the polls. And so, you know, it's not like Republicans have a great track record on this particular issue here. So, yes, there's been a lot of concern. Whether or not it'll actually play out, we don't quite know yet.
Florida has a lot of elderly people, and I would imagine that some of these things also make it harder for them to vote.
Yes, Republicans were the ones who pushed for vote by mail voting in Florida. They made it so that, you know, in Florida, you didn't need a reason to vote by mail. And this was because it was very popular in their base, especially among older voters who might not want to go to the polling place and stand in line. So, yes, this is it's something that has been very, very popular with older voters and with Republicans.
The former president, Donald Trump, falsely alleged there was widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. There's no evidence to back up those claims, but Florida has actually had some issues with voter fraud in more local elections. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, Florida has a long history of voter fraud, specifically with vote-by-mail ballots. Going back to the last few decades, in the late 90s, the Miami mayor's race was overturned because of this. There have been multiple statewide grand juries convened pointing out that, hey, there are these massive loopholes in voting by mail. And, you know, frankly, the irony here is that Republicans were the ones who have not done anything about this until now. You know, the way vote by mail fraud usually works in Florida is people go to your house. They know when you're sent a vote by mail ballot. Politicians and candidates and committees know when you're sent a vote-by-mail ballot. They know when you've sent one in. And so if they see you haven't turned one in, they'll go to your house. Well, the grand jury, there was a statewide grand jury convened in 2012 to address all these concerns because it just keeps happening in Florida. And they recommended, hey, don't tell candidates and committees when somebody sent a vote-by-mail ballot because that they know who to target. And of course, they did not do anything on that issue. I actually spoke to Republicans about this saying, why aren't you doing this? And they said, well, we want to be able to, you know who hasn't voted yet to turn out more democracy. In other words, it's politically inconvenient for them and for the Democrats as well, you know, because they rely on these kinds of voters to on this data to find voters who haven't turned in their ballots and go to their house, collect their ballot. In some cases, in the fraudulent cases, they've been pressuring people to fill out their ballots. In some cases, we found evidence that they've been signing people's ballots in some cases over the years. So this is not a new issue at all.
So does this bill actually address the legitimate complaints that have been found?
In one way, it does. It restricts people from possessing more than two ballots at a time. And this is, you know, it's targeting what's known in Florida and around, you've heard former President Donald Trump say this, ballot harvesting, where people will go around and collect ballots and stuff. And, you know, that has been the real source of vote by mail fraud in Florida is this kind of ballot harvesting. In small races, not statewide races, but we haven't seen any kind of the widespread voting fraud. But anyway, they did crack down on that. They made it so you can't possess more than two ballots, which again, that used to be in state law from the late 90s after the Miami scandals in the late 90s till 2001, you were prohibited from possessing more than two ballots. And Republicans were the ones who did away with that provision because again, it was politically inconvenient. So that's back on the books now.
How is all of this landing with voters?
Well, Republicans say they did poll on this issue quite a bit. And of course, if you poll people saying, you know, who's in favor of voter fraud or would you like to see less voter fraud, who's going to say no to that?
Right.
And, you know, Republicans are in a politically precarious situation here where, you know, the leader of their party just alleged widespread voter fraud. You know, it looks a little silly if, you know, in Florida, the Republicans control the legislature if they didn't do anything about this topic. I think that voters are not necessarily opposed to the idea of strengthening the system. I think people are very suspicious of the motivations, the reasoning for it. Why do it now?
What happens next?
Well, I expect there will be some legal challenges to this at some point. You know, a lot of the changes to this bill are administrative. They deal with how vote by mail ballots can be counted and challenged. Election supervisors have raised a lot of concerns about some of those provisions because it could really cause people to jam up. You know, if you basically challenge a bunch of vote by mail ballots, it can tie up an election. And so I think a lot of this, the effects of this remain to be seen. Well, I don't know if we're going to find out for maybe a year or two.
Lawrence Maurer, a reporter with the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As we've been hearing, voting restriction bills have been on the rise this year. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, more than 300 of these bills have been introduced in 47 states. And in Arizona, which has introduced 23 voting restriction bills so far this year, voting rights advocates are concerned that this legislation will make it harder for Native communities to vote, a key demographic that helped President Biden secure the state last November. For more on this, I'm joined by Tori Dolan, a Native Vote Fellow at Arizona State University's Indian Legal Clinic and a member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the specific legislation, last fall, you spent Election Day doing field calls for Native Vote Arizona's election protection hotline. What issues were you hearing that Native communities in Arizona were struggling with in general when it comes to voting?
In general, we saw issues with some polling locations not being open on time, voters being wrongfully turned away because of ID or possibly because confusion about what precinct they're in because of the reality of having non-standard addresses on reservations, as well as voter intimidation and some instances of voter harassment.
One of the proposed bills would require proof of ID for mail-in ballots. What issues would that create for Indigenous communities in Arizona?
So the original version of that bill, SB 1713, included the use of tribal ID, which is a valid form of ID to present when you're voting in person. However, the bill was subject to a strike all amendment, and so tribal ID no longer qualifies. The two forms of ID numbers that you would have to put on your ballot by mail would be your driver's license or your voter registration number. Indigenous communities, generally because of rates of poverty or lack of access, do not have driver's license numbers at the same rate. And Maricopa County is the only county where you can verify your voter registration number online. We also know that minority language speakers may have issues getting a hold of their voter registration number because they would have to call the county directly, and there's no guarantee that there's going to be somebody at the county office that speaks their language. The other issue is that it requires that you put your date of birth, and we know that many Indigenous elders here in the state of Arizona were born at home and have delayed birth certificates or government records that estimate a birthday. So many of them don't know what their government assigned birthday is. And if you get that number wrong, your ballot will have to be cured, meaning that the county is going to have to reach out to you, which is a difficult process for hard to reach Indigenous communities that don't have access to electricity or phone services.
You mentioned language, and I'm wondering what role language plays in terms of voter access for Native communities and whether any of these proposed laws impact this.
Language access is a big deal for Indigenous communities here in Arizona. There are two tribes where their reservations are covered by Section 203 of the Voting Rights Act. The San Carlos Apache tribe on their reservation and the Navajo Nation on their reservation have a right to minority language assistance. One bill that was passed out of both houses and is being sent to the governor's desk this week is SB 1003, which essentially that bill gives the county less time to cure a ballot with a missing signature. And the Navajo Nation brought a lawsuit in 2018 challenging that practice because you have 5 business days after the election to cure a mismatched signature. But nobody was translating the instructions to Navajo language speakers that you had to sign the ballot. And so they were turning in their ballot unsigned. In 2019, the Navajo Nation entered into settlement agreements with the 3 counties that cover the reservation, as well as the Secretary of State's office, to address this ambiguity in the law, to have unsigned ballots treated the same as mismatched signatures. However, the bill that's passed completely undermines that settlement.
If you have these questions about language and then also proof of ID, how does that work for early and absentee voting?
So Indigenous people don't vote by mail at the same rate as the rest of Arizona because they don't have the same access to mail on reservations. It can take 10 days for a piece of mail to get from the county seat to a reservation in some instances. And so they're historically has been less use of voting by mail. But as a result of the pandemic, more people opted to vote by mail in tribal communities. the access to translators is a barrier because although they have a right to it provided by the county, many Indigenous people who vote by mail rely on family to translate a ballot. And now with the voter ID issue, when voting by mail, it will completely disrupt the process for those who have newly moved to voting by mail and may not know how to navigate that ID provision. And we anticipate that should that bill become law, we'll probably see a number of ballots returned from tribal communities without that ID.
Is there any indication as to why this is happening? Is it targeting the Native community, or are they caught up in something broader?
I certainly can't speak to the intent of the legislators, but I know from listening to committee hearings and floor debates that the regular reason offered for introducing these bills is voter integrity. I certainly haven't seen evidence myself as to what suggests that Arizona's election system is lacking integrity, but there certainly has been comments in these hearings and on the floor from non-Indigenous representatives and Indigenous representatives about what the impact on tribal communities will be. But unfortunately, some of the bills are moving nonetheless.
We don't have a lot of time left, but there is a voting rights bill in the U.S. Senate. If that passes, will that have any effect on what's happening in Arizona?
Yes. So some of the bills that are introduced in the U.S. Congress will preempt a lot of existing Arizona law and may preempt a number of these bad bills to increase access.
Tori Dolan is a Native Vote Fellow at Arizona State University's Indian Legal Clinic. Tori, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Last spring, at the start of the pandemic, we checked in with different comedians to find out how they were dealing with the closure of live venues and whether the shift to virtual comedy shows was working for them. Now, roughly a year later, live indoor comedy shows are finally becoming a safer reality. And that means that a lot of comics can once again hear how audiences respond to their jokes in person without having to decipher reactions over Zoom. Comedian and Saturday Night Live cast member Melissa Villaseñor has been performing in front of masked, socially distanced audiences for SNL since last October. Here she is speaking with Colin Jost about quarantining alone last year.
I'll be honest, it wasn't super fun all the time. Like at first, all I wanted to do was watch silly, stupid stuff. So I found that old show, The Little Rascals. Colin, I would laugh so hard, I couldn't make out a single word they were saying. They sounded like this.
Hamburger.
Yeah, all I understood was hamburger.
At the end of this month, Melissa is set to perform stand-up in multiple cities, and she's here with me now to discuss getting back out on the road. Melissa, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me, and thanks for sharing the Little Rascals clip.
So you started performing again in front of in-studio audiences for SNL last fall. What did it feel like to do it again after months of no live shows?
I mean, first, it was a shock to the system, you know, because suddenly, boom, you're around so many people, especially on the floor, and then we had to go jump on stage without masks. It was a little trippy for me.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, the muscle of that show came back quickly, and it just felt really nice to have crowds again and laughing and live. I mean, that was just so cool. But I think I've gotten used to the rhythm of testing, COVID testing, and the, you know, sorry, there's a motorcycle.
It's okay.
Hey, it's New York, baby.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, yeah, it was very strange, but I'm just grateful to be back with crowds there and also now this tour in the summer.
Yeah. Does it make it harder to know if an audience is with you if they've got masks on? Like, can you tell if you're bringing them along?
I mean, you know, you got to look right in their eyes to really have some hope. They're laughing. I even did, you know, it is tough. I did a couple outdoor shows when I was home in LA, and the masks were on and it was outdoors. And I honestly couldn't tell up there. I was like, I don't know if they're having fun. It's hard, but I think once, now that the shows that I'll be doing will be inside, it'll help to have that cover of the roof for the laughs, you know, that's everything. Or maybe I really bombed. I don't know.
No, for the stand-up tour, like, do you feel more prepared since you have been doing SNL? Did it like warm up that muscle again?
Yeah, in that sense, where SNL, yes, being in front of audiences, but in terms of stand-up, it's a whole other, you know, muscle to get back. So that's why I'm doing so many shows, just because I want to strengthen back that hour that I was working on. And by the time I get to LA, I'm going to tape it, because I need a comedy special out there in the world, you know? So, sorry, my cat, she keeps putting her butt in my face.
Will she be joining you on tour?
Yeah, no, Ella's not. She's going to stay here in New York. My sister lives here too, thankfully. So, and I have there's a dog walker who takes care of my dog, and they also take care of cats. So Ella's in good hands. But Penny, my dog, will be joining me on the road, which is awesome. I mean, that's the best.
Yeah. You told the AV Club that, you know, some of this stand-up material is stuff you've been working on for years. I wonder, like, did you tailor anything to post-pandemic times? Or do you think audiences are going to respond to kind of before times jokes in a different way?
No, I feel like a lot of the bits I have, they're personal, whether it's about family members or my own self just being alone at home. It's not really about COVID, none of the stuff, but there's some newer bits, but it's everything's kind of evergreen. I'm going to use that word. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like the especially with like the impression bits, they're based on, you know, being at SNL or just personal, you know, things like why I love Steve Buscemi. He soothes my soul, you know, or Owen. Like it doesn't really have anything to do with COVID, and I think it flows well. So
maybe people need that, something that's not about COVID.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I don't want to talk, it exhausts me to even think about. So I feel like it's my place to heal. I like to say this, I heal myself with the silly thoughts and jokes, and I heal the crowd at the same time. So that's what I like to go up there as.
Does that feel like pressure?
No, because my main goal is making my own self laugh. And if they're on board, that's great. That's my goal. And I feel like that's what the special is. All the bits are just, how do I be my own best friend? And how can I make myself laugh each day? And I think my fans know that by now. And they know that I don't add any pressure.
Is there anything specific, like any bits that you've been working on that you're particularly excited to try out in front of a real crowd?
I'm excited. Yeah, I feel like my new boyfriend, I feel like it's exciting to talk about because he's a violinist. And sometimes I feel like I'm on the Titanic and it's sinking when he's playing. So there's a lot of like personal things that I'm very excited to. The real bits, you know, about my life those are the ones I really want to keep working on. I'm very excited to share with the crowd.
Yeah. Do you get nervous at all about, you know, being in front of people in terms of COVID?
With that stuff. Well, I think once I get my second dose Tuesday, I'll be calmer. But I always make sure the mic is sanitized. There's no one in the direct, like, front row. And then I feel okay. I feel like if I'm spaced out enough, I feel good. And no meet and greets, sadly. I know everyone wants a hug, but unfortunately.
Not now.
Not right now.
Melissa Villaseñor is a stand-up comedian and a cast member of Saturday Night Live. Her multi-city stand-up tour kicks off at the end of the month. Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. right, folks, that is all for us today. Glad to have you here along for the ride. And remember, if you want to get in touch, there are a lot of ways to go about it. One of them is to click on Contact Us at thetakeaway.org and record a message, and it goes right to us. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway.